All right.
Okay, this evening's lecture is on the 100th anniversary of the Great Chabig Golf Club. And our speaker is Linda Grant, who has been working on the research for this project for a year or two, I believe. And I'm excited about hosting this lecture. And I know many of you who are Zoomed in this evening are golf club members, and we're excited for all of you. Now, we are recording tonight. If that's not something you'd like to have happen, then you'll have to exit. And also, as you may know, we don't have a fee for our lectures, but we do have an opportunity for people to donate on our website, chabighistory.com. And our next lecture will be in September. It's September 20th. And it is Dr. Chuck Ravis, or Ravis, who was doctor to the islands of Casco Bay back in the 80s. And he's written a book. We have it on sale at the museum, and we'll be excited to hear from him. But this evening, we are excited to hear from Linda. Thank you all. Take it away, Linda.
Okay, thank you, Mary. And I want to, first of all, thank the Historical Society for inviting the golf club to talk about its history for its centennial, which actually is now centennial and one, because we celebrated our centennial in 2020. And of course, because of COVID, we had to put off all our activities and our displays. And luckily, a couple of weeks ago, we were able to have our celebration, but it would be our 101 year. And I'll explain that as I go along, why we celebrate in 2020 from 1920. I also want to just tell you a little bit that we have a large pictorial display that is going to be up at the club starting on Friday the 13th, this coming Friday, and it will be there for about 12 days. And we would love to have everybody in the community come up and enjoy seeing that and learning a little bit more. And while you're there, you might want to look at our new book, which is The Great Chabig Golf Club. It's celebrating 100 years. This was produced and published in June by three club members, and we're very excited about it. And I think you'll enjoy the pictures and the story. And with that, I'm going to start with this first picture, which is showing the golf club, we believe, in the 1950s. And when people first see this photograph, this aerial photograph, they always go like, where are all the trees? Well, in those days, it was a little bit clearer, but we now have trees in the middle of the fairway. Oops, I have to turn it. I got it wrong. I'm going to get this. I'm new at this. We have trees in the middle of these two fairways. We have trees in the middle of these two fairways. We have some crabapple trees up in here, and we have more trees. And we've lost some trees and we've gained some trees. But this is the way it looked in the 1950s. And we feel very lucky to have a beautiful aerial photograph like this. Before the golf club started, it looked like this. This is a pastoral scene at the corner of South Road and what was called Hamilton Wharf Road. We call it Wharf Road today, and it went down to Hamilton Landing. And this young man is sitting on the fence in this, was a pasture. And it belonged to the estate of David and Hill family, and it was about 16 acres of land. And Mrs. Nellie Hill Hamilton, daughter of David Hill, and great granddaughter of Solomon Sawyer.
All right. I'm not paying attention to it.
who had built a home. Solomon Sawyer built a house which was on this 16 acres of land in the early 1800s. And he was asked in, Is somebody talking? I guess not. Okay. They were asked in 1920 about the use of the land for a potential golf course. And Mrs. Nellie Hill stated that this property could be rented for $50 per year with an option to buy, depending on her sister, Mrs. Manley Littlefield, agreeing. That agreement went forward with an option running for 5 years, but in the end, they changed it to 3 years when the golf course actually purchased the property. Now, when Solomon Sawyer built a house, which is now our, it still continues to be our clubhouse, and we'll learn a little bit more about that later, he sold it to David N. Hill, formerly a stone slooper. Captain Hill did farm the land, and he brought in rockweed from the shore as his fertilizer, which people still do today. But by the time of 1920, the land was used only as a pasture and was considered wasteland in its assessed valuation. Charles Hamilton was using the pasture at a cost of $15 annually to have his cows pastured there. The final price that the golf club paid for this first 16 acres was $100 per acre and $200 for the house, which was in very poor condition. So who were the people who, here is the condition of the house when we purchased it. And these six men are our founders, and we honor them by having a photo array in the main room of the clubhouse. It is said that two men in August 1920 were in the fields picking blueberries when they brought up a discussion, the idea of a golf course. In the late 1800s and into the early 1900s, rusticators had begun coming to Maine in the summer, and Chibig was as popular as many other coastal islands along in Maine. These rusticators, so named because they came to spend weeks or months in a more rural place than perhaps their urban homes in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and beyond. The two men who were in the field were George Spalding and B.R.T. Collins. And I'll tell you a little bit about them. Mr. George Spalding was in his early 60s at that time. And he was, when he was young, an athlete at Exeter Academy and Harvard College. And in his early 60s, he became an ardent golfer, coming to Chibig on the weekends from Boston overnight on a side wheeler, then by island steamer to one of the Chibig wharfs. Bertrand Robeson Torsey, B.R.T. Collins, was also from the Boston area. Both of these men realized how much easier the transportation to the island was becoming, and they felt that the younger people who might want to come would want to play golf. So this was their idea of how to attract them. It is said that Mr. Collins was the single individual who pursued the formation of the golf course and its success in the years to come. There are many, many letters in our archives written by Mr. Collins to encourage purchase of property, upgrades to the course, and membership. He, like Mr. Spalding, was a golfer and for many years belonged to the Chestnut Hill Club in Massachusetts, even while assuring that the island would have their golf course. And he was an engineer, so he delighted in designing the first holes of the course. A third founder was Alice Ames Ballard, who came to the island from Philadelphia and built a home on the West End. He and his wife, Nina, assisted in the purchase of several pieces of land beyond the pasture to grow the course to its current size. He oversaw the incorporation of the club in 1923, and his wife, Nina, skippered the Ballard's yacht to Portland to bring the founders there to sign the papers to incorporate the club. Lewis Chandler, this young man here, was our first president, and he was president for several years. We have Edward P. Gwillem, who is the fifth founder and one of the original incorporators. came to the Shebig at the age of 17, staying at the Hillcrest Hotel. In 1918, he had become a regular summer visitor and rented the house now occupied by the Houghtons. The first meeting to organize the club was actually held in that house. Billy William Hill, down this man with the gun, was born and raised on the island and became famous as a marksman. He, due to the death of his father, when he was 12, he left school and pursued a variety of jobs, but is best known for being a representative for the Remington Arms Company. And he went around the country to demonstrate guns. He came back to the island for a short time in the 1920s, but lived away until 1946. He served as clerk for the club, as you have to have a resident of Maine, which is true to this day, that a resident of Maine has to be a clerk. Remembering that Mr. Collins and Mr. Spalding came up with the idea for the golf course in August 1920, it is hard to believe that the first golf was actually played in September 1920. Charles Hamilton, who was still pasturing his cows on the site at his rental of the pasture, didn't end until December of that year, kindly asked that if they played golf, not to hit his cows. So we hope that didn't happen. We don't know for sure. We think it might have happened. Spalding and Collins came up with the design of the course. I'm going to get the map here now. Okay. This is the original map for the six holes. But when they originally designed the course, they came up with nine holes for the 16 acres. But when Mr. Ballard saw the design for the nine holes, he pointed out to them that it would be better to have six good holes rather than nine poor ones. So the three men, we don't know if it was that day or the next day, but it was very soon after that, they came out with stakes and they marked the tees and the greens as we see them. And they had someone clear and mow the greens, so to speak. And the first golf was played very early in September of 1920. Now on this map, you'll see that the this was where they called it the clubhouse and the tea room. And that was the original farmhouse. And it was still in the area, in the pasture. So to another where it had, we'll learn that it was moved over to this area later. And so the golf started by going out from the clubhouse, which you had to walk over to by the shoreline and go out and back and out and back. And it ended up back at the clubhouse. Now remember that we didn't own the land that came all the way. When I say we, I mean the club did not own the land all the way to the road. There was something called the Indian Village. There was the baseball ground, and there was the land across the street, across the road. Now, as we go along, we also realize that there was a cottage here called the Cole Cottage. This is the second map as we acquired more land. To orient yourself, when they say to the bathing beach, that's going past this house, which is the Houghton's house, to the beach. And this is the main road to Central Landing, which we call the North Road. And this is to Eastern Landing, because remember there were hotels and boarding houses up this way. And up here in this area was the Hillcrest Hotel. I have to catch up with myself here. So we still had, in the very first years, we had the Native Americans camping this area from the wharf up here. We had a coal cottage. We had the baseball ground. So they played all around that. But when we acquired this land across the street, which is now, they hear it's the fifth and sixth fairway. Today, it's the fourth and fifth fairway. They changed the way, and the first hole went down here to the main road, North Road, that corner, and then it went up in the second hole, etc. And after the club was incorporated in 1923, they decided that they wanted to expand it to 9 holes. And how did they get that property? Well, here's a short idea. They had 8 pieces of property, which they purchased. In April 1924, they purchased what they call the Indian lot, which was from the pier down here, the landing, all the way up to the coal cottage, but not including it. And it included the cemetery, which we know now is in front of the clubhouse. Then in May 1924, they purchased the Needham lot, which went back here, which is now today our 4th fairway and today our 5th fairway. But on this map, it's the 5th fairway and the 6th fairway. Then in July of 1924, they extended into in front of the Hillcrest and were able to purchase this particular land here. So they bought this Needham lot, but in actuality, they didn't own in front of this Needham lot. So they purchased that land, and except for this York cottage, which is today the Holbaum house and land. Then in September 1924, so they were very busy in 1924 spending money. I don't know if they played golf, but they spent a lot of money. The hills and gullies of the south side of the Hills estate were purchased. And then they made the course like it is today. And then we went on to and here is a picture from the porch of the cottage next to the Hillcrest Hotel. And you can see here, there's the coal cottage, which I've been talking about. And here is, this is the fairways, but we still did not own this property in front of the Hillcrest Hotel where the ball field was. They didn't purchase that land until 1930. And it was actually purchased by Mrs. Ballard and given to the golf club. And that is currently where our first green is located and our second tee. And there is no longer, of course, a ball field there. Now we hit across the road to down to the second fairway. So we had about 40 acres of land at that point. Today we have a little bit more acreage than that because we did purchase the corner property a couple of years ago, which used to hold the Catholic Church and before that the tea house. So this gives you a version from the early 1920s. Okay. This picture shows you also what they had when they had a field day. And I assume that it was a lot of summer people who came to visit, but I'm hoping that a lot of islanders participated in this as well. No, Donna says no. Summer people came and they played games and they enjoyed all of this land, and the golf club also began to participate in those as soon as they were formed. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the Native Americans, what I know, but I don't have a photograph of that. But we do know that they could have come here for perhaps 1,000 years. We don't know for how long they came here. In the summertime, they came from inland Maine down to the shoreline, up the down the rivers, and some of them came to the islands, and they fished and they camped here and utilized all the waters. And then in the late 1800s and into the 1920s, the Native Americans, we do know, were the Penobscot Nation of the Wabanaki Confederacy. And they continued to come to the island, and their teepees were found along the Wharf Road. They were moved at a certain point by the golf club. They asked them to move around to the South Road, so that they wouldn't be in the way of the golf plane. And they did that. And we do know that one family came to the area of what is where the currently the tennis courts are, and they released that land for $1 from the golf club. And they made baskets from the nearby swamp reeds, and they had a concession there. And I think many people may who are listening here tonight may have some of those baskets in their cottages or their houses, or they may remember the concession. And I know that there are people on the island who know that family quite well. I want to show you a few pictures of the, this is another great picture showing the golf club. And this is the baseball field. And this is a view across the first and second fairways from the club. And this is, you notice the, yes. Here we are in the back, the third tee playing from the woods. I noticed that a lot of these men don't have ties on. I thought they actually sometimes wore ties when they were playing golf. I don't know how. Then we have our famous seventh hole. And this is one of the things that makes our course unique. I think like people come here, not just to play golf, but they've heard about this seventh hole where you hit over the salt water. And of course we have the beautiful scenes from every hole. But here you see they hit from here over to this green. And look here, it's very easy to see how few trees there were at that time. Here again, they are on the seventh hole. You look back at the wharf, that building at the end of the wharf, which, it's a coal shed. And this was
fish market. The store.
And it burned.
The store burned.
Down. But they hit from here. Now, what we think about the seventh hole, it was in the original design, but it wasn't there. It was going to be on this side of the water, as we would say. But when they purchased the land from what I call the Indian land that they purchased from the shore up to the coal cottage, we think that perhaps there was some agreement that they could use the pier for their hole, for the seventh hole, because it's about that time. We know they were playing on it in 1927. Here it is. Here you see the rubble from the fire on the wharf. They played right through that. Again, they're still wearing those wonderful white clothes. This is an early SWAT fest. The SWAT fest started around 1922 or 23. And as far as we know, it's been played almost every year except during World War II. And it's always played on the weekend of the 4th of July. That's when it started. And in the late 30s, they started having two SWAT fests a year, one and Labor Day. I also read recently that the women of the club were asked after the SWAT fest to prepare a buffet dinner, and they served that. Today, we have the SWAT fest, and we have juniors, and everybody any age can play in it, and other people are welcome. This year, we had somebody that was staying at the inn played, and he had the audacity to win the tournament. we laugh about that, but he's a really nice young man. Anyway, we have a junior tournament. We have this, but this is playing on what was the second hole. This would be over here, the North Road. And that was the second hole at that time. And there's a wonderful chapter in our book, the Centennial book, about the SWAT Fest. So you can read all about it. It's too long to tell you how we play it. So you'll have to come and join us. This is an original tee box. And in the 1920s, a lot of earlier clubs, I'm saying that were established in the 1880s and 90s, of which there are many, were starting to use the wooden tees that we know today. They weren't exactly like the wooden tees we use today. But here when they started, they had tee boxes. And what this was full of sand. And when you came up to the tee, you took a funnel, a shape of a funnel, and you filled it with sand. And I'm told they poured a little water on it and then they tipped it out and it made a cone shape, and that was your tee. So you had that to do before you actually hit the ball. Now, I began thinking about that the other day, how they all had white clothes on and they were making their tees with this sand. And I just don't really know what that looked like. But anyway, we don't see those tees or hear anything about them, these tee boxes, after they actually formed the nine holes. So we're not sure when they stopped having this kind of tee box. So now we go to the clubhouse. Again, I'm showing you a picture before the clubhouse was moved, when it was originally on the site of what was called the orchard in the pasture land. And it's where our third fairway is today. When they started the club, using that as the clubhouse in 1922, the golf club actually spent $825, which was quite a bit of money for that time, to improve the building. And what they did was they removed the walls inside, and then they made sidewalls so there were different conformation of the rooms. They installed a new floor, and the chimney was repaired. And they also put in a sink and a hand pump to provide water inside. In 1928, they moved the clubhouse 150 yards. That's a little something I have to say. Let's see. How am I doing, Donna?
Good.
Here's our clubhouse. Of course, it didn't look like that when they moved it, but they moved it. And it was a distance of just about 150 yards, and they added a porch at a cost of $350. They also put in a septic tank, and they put in an awning over what we would call the east porch, which now has a roof. 2 years later, they established the men's locker room, which was upstairs, and they had 18 steel lockers and a bathroom, which was very rustic. It's still in current use, and it's still very rustic. but anyway, this is a beautiful picture of our clubhouse as it stands today. We have the cemetery, which many people come up just to see this cemetery, and they ask a lot of questions about it. It's called the Chandler and Keyser Family Cemetery. That family lived in what was the York House, now the Holbaum House. There are four graves here. A lot of people tried to tell me there were more than four graves, but there are four graves, and we have four markers, and the other are footstones. There are no relatives of this Keyser Holbaum family, Keyser Chandler family living on the island at this time. And the club keeps up the gravestones, so we, in honor of that family. We also, Ted Curtis and Sky Grant recently cleaned it and straightened up the stones so that we could read the engravings on them. And I think the one that everyone is most familiar with is Reuben Keyser, who is this large stone. He died in November of 1816 at the age of 39. And on that stone, it says, "Stop by all my friends as you pass by, as you are once was I. As I am now, soon you must be. Therefore, prepare to follow me." So we enjoy this cemetery. We take care of it. We don't park our bicycles in it. We don't park our golf carts in it, but some people hit balls in it sometimes. There it is, the stone I was just reading from, the marker. This is a picture of the ladies' golf. We believe this is 2012 or 13. And I love this picture because it has people that are no longer with us. And so we can enjoy seeing them, and they played with us. But this allows me to talk a little bit about the women of the club, because we had women right from the beginning. Some of the first stockholders, I believe it was three, were members of the club, and the wives who didn't play golf were involved. And they began having tea parties up there. We have a beautiful silver tea service still, which you can see if you come up to enjoy the pictorial show that we have. And they gave teas and they had bridge, but they also ran quite a bit of the entertainment. Of course, I'm sure the men helped out because they needed to earn a lot of money to put back into the clubhouse and into the course. And today that's still true, that we all work very hard and to make it possible that our clubhouse is in the best condition possible. But that also, I wanted to tell you about all of the entertainment that went on at the golf club in the 20s, the 30s, in the 40s after World War II, in the 50s. They had croquet and club clock golf. They had carnivals. They had, as I said before, teas. They had bridge tournaments. And they also had dances. And they had outdoor movies, which were up at the Hamilton and Hillcrest Hotel. They had clam bakes. And in the minutes, I found 1 year in the late 1930s, they had 7 dances, 5 movie nights, a carnival, a bake food sale, tea parties, and bridge for the ladies. And that was an addition, of course, to playing golf and having golf tournaments. So they were, it's quite a, the membership enjoys getting together. And at that time, they must have had a lot of fun making money on these entertainments. And here we have our 90th anniversary celebration, which was in 2010. So that was 11 years ago, because remember, we couldn't celebrate in our 100th year. And then a lot of the people enjoyed that evening because we were asked to dress up like we were in the 20s or 30s or the early golfers. And so you can enjoy that in this picture and see all the people. And some of the people who are no longer with us or can't come to the golf club anymore. So it's a very fun picture. And I wanted to also mention that the golf club in 2015 was placed on the National Register of Historic Sites. There are a few golf clubs in Maine which have that designation, and also throughout the country, but it means that it's the national, it's part of the national heritage of our country to be on the National Register for Historic Sites. And in the entire clubhouse and the entire course, it's not just the clubhouse. Some people think, oh, the clubhouse because it's an old building from the 1800s, but its entire course is part of that designation. And we always look to the future at our club. We're always trying to think about how we can move forward, what we can do to make the house better, what we can do to make the course better. We've established a very nice endowment by raising money in two of our, in the 90th anniversary and for the 100th anniversary. But our future is in the youth. And this is a grandson of one of our members. And it makes us feel very proud that our kids come to our junior camp, which we just had, not last week, but the week before. We also have junior golf every Thursday afternoon at 3:30 for anybody. Anybody can come to these events. And we're hoping that they all come back and play golf there and bring their families. And we look to our future also in the way that we can sustain the course environmentally correctly to help the island out. And we do everything possible to provide as much for the island from in our course. You're all welcome to come to play, to visit our clubhouse and enjoy it. Now I would like to ask a few other people, members of the club, if they would speak. I don't know if David Hill might want to speak first about his grandfather. Do you want to say anything, David?
Well, yeah, I might as well. There's another, my grandfather had a tie to the golf course before it was the golf course. And that is the fact that he was actually born in what is now the clubhouse when it was back in its earlier incarnation and not where it's located now. And I also wanted to mention that, as the clerk of the corporation in the early days, he lived right across from where the Native Americans had their stand. And I do remember that. I'm old enough for those. Remember those sweet baskets. What's it called? Anyway,
sweet grass.
Yeah, I remember those baskets, and we still have a few of those. And that house is where the Federleys are now. That's my contribution.
Thank you, David. I have Jack Turner is going to come. He's in Cambridge today, but he's going to talk to us. Jack,
I'm unmuting. I've just unmuted myself. You know.
Yes.
Though I took my first steps on the island in 1945, I wasn't on the island very much before I moved moved from Indiana to Cambridge for college in 1962. But in the early 1970s, when T and I started coming to the island together, we decided to ask our neighbor, Gardner Lang, how we might become members of the club. Neither of us played golf, but we saw it as a community resource and we wanted to support it. Gardner recommended that we both become proprietary members, and we did so with his support. My story this evening is mostly about my family's history with the island and the golf club, since neither T nor I began playing golf until a few years ago. The cottage that T and I now own was purchased by my great-grandmother, Margaret Newell, in 1905, a few years after she and her family had visited the island and stayed at one of the several resort hotels in 1903. My maternal grandfather, William Newell, was one of the early members of the club. And another of my great grandmothers, Elizabeth Sewell from Little John Island, was one of the first women members of the club. There were many inter-island gatherings in the early 1900s, many of which centered on the golf club when it was founded in 1920. And it was through these gatherings that my grandmother, Margaret Newell from Chabig, my grandfather, Lincoln Sewell from Little John, met and later married. Ownership of the cottage that T and I now own passed from my great-grandmother to my great-aunt, Polly Newell, in 1929. And I bought the cottage from Polly when I was 23 in 1967. Both Polly and her sister, Margaret, my grandmother, were social members of the club, but I don't think either of them played golf. Our son, Lincoln, who began playing on the island when he was 6 years old, is now a very powerful player, and much of that can be traced to the years when he was able to be on the course and get instruction. It wasn't until T and I decided to take up golf in, we think, 2009, that I began to play. And most of the time we enjoy the game.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you very much. And now Rosemary Capps Merchant. She's on here, will speak. Rosemary, can you unmute?
Okay, my first memory on the golf course is not of golf, but of blueberries. The slope in front of the 16 was covered with scrubby growth and blueberries, so it was a favorite spot. And also the rough above the fourth fairway, short of the trees and toward the hotel, had buried treasure in the tall grass. So my mom would take Sally and me up to pick in the late afternoons when there weren't too many golfers. Those were the days when you could sit in the grass and pick and not worry about Lyme disease or brown tail moth or any of the stuff that we have to think about now. But at some point I realized that while the white ball may not have tasted as good as the berries, it was actually what the course was set out for. And we'd go up in the afternoons with my parents to play a few holes. I always preferred playing barefoot until that was discouraged because of insecticides. I've had island family on both my parents' sides involved with the club, from my mother's uncle, B.R.T. Collins, and all his descendants, to my dad's father, Stephen Reed Capps II, about whom I've never heard a single golf story, as he spent many summers in the field mapping Alaska. My dad had the most history with the club, though. He won the first, no, I guess it wasn't the first July Swat Fest in 1931. He won the July Swat Fest in 1931. The little brown book says that it was the first one. He was clubhouse attendant, assistant to Guard Lang in 1933, and along with Wally Weiss for 1934. Those were the days when the ladies came for tea and bridge, and when they were short a player, he had to fill in. So one day he got a hand with 12 cards in the same suit and promptly bid 6 no trump, figuring he'd never get trumped on. Of course, he never got the lead and didn't take a single trick. Dad was president of the club. Fast forward a few years, he was president of the club from 1980 to 1982, and he always said that that was the first time the club had an official published budget. Dad played, that sounds like they just spent money until then. Dad played a lot of golf over his lifetime. He told of playing with Bill Swan and each of them lining up 2 balls in a row to see if they could hit both over the gully out of the woods. All of his gang of teenagers played in those days. And if I tried to name them all, I'd forget someone. In his prime, he played with all the guys. In later years, Lewis Ross and Gerald Colbeth were frequent partners, and also Andre Benoit, who would come over from Cliff Island. For his last SWAT fest, my dad could barely stand up unaided, but he was determined to play and to be the oldest participant in the field. So my husband, John, had him out in our yard practicing that all-important shot off the first tee. And on the first day of the SWAT test, he got up there and hit a decent shot with John there to catch him if necessary. That was his last SWAT fest. Moments of glory. Holes in one in the Caps family. Dad on number 6 and Mom on number 8. Me? Well, I didn't add my voice to those at the gala, but one day on 7, playing with my sister Sally, I hit a ball from the tee right into the cup. Unfortunately, I had already dumped one into the water, and it was my second shot. It took quite a while for me to stop Sally from whooping it up by saying, "That's a par." Winning mother-daughter, father-daughter, and husband-wife cups were family highlights. And playing one of my best rounds ever against our esteemed president, Sally Crapser, in the final round of one of the women's tournaments, we went to the 19th hole all even. I chipped close to the hole and Sally was in trouble above that insidious number 1 green. So I don't think I need to tell you who chipped in for the win. It was not me. I played against Nikki Weldon the first time I was brave enough to enter a tournament. And on the first hole, she hit one left into the jungle and announced that she would take a mulligan. In my naivete, I didn't question it. And so she took her mulligan. Another experience was playing Mary Raymond, who was easily more than twice my age, and conceding to her beautiful game on the 6th hole, 4 and 3. There are many more stories, but it's remembering family, friends, and those who are no longer with us that makes playing our course about so much more than playing golf. I feel their presence out there every time I'm on the course. That's what I have to say.
Thank you, Rosemary, very much. That was fun. And now John Lang is here, and he, John, are you there?
I'm here.
Linda, would you please unshare your screen so that John can share his screen? And I will give John, he's going to be a co-host now, along with.
There you go.
All right. So now John should be able to share his screen and proceed.
So, my dad has been mentioned a couple of times here. Let me get this. Can everyone see this?
Yep.
Okay, so this is my dad and his sister, Ginny Flick, who they were about, 1920. So he was about 9 years old. She was a little bit younger. And I guess my internet connection isn't all that stable, but he was a fanatic about golf, and he was out there. He insisted that all five of us play as much as we could. In fact, we were required pretty much to play, you know, at least three holes a day. He'd kick us out of the house, and, you know, we'd sometimes play more, but we always hit four and five. They were long holes. They were tough. But he just loved the game and instilled upon all of us a love for the game. And we're all very lucky to have had such a unique experience. Rosie mentioned playing barefoot. We all did for many years. Kids membership back then was $5 for the entire season. And it was just a wonderful time. We mentioned the clubhouse earlier, and yes, we're in the historic places, I should say. But we also think that it's probable that clubhouse, a golf club, is one of the oldest clubhouses in America. David, I think it was built in, 1790, something like that?
1807.
Okay. But it has to be one of the oldest. So we should be very proud of that. So, and by the way, SWAT fests were required. This is my entire family. We're getting out there. You can see, Joni wouldn't approve of seeing this, but this is Joan. We've got Brian over on the side. Sue, Sally, our current president, and me and my mom. So I thought I'd show this picture. This is Joni teeing off. All of my sisters were attendants at the clubhouse. It is something they really looked forward to doing. Joni worked with Gail Shute, now Gail Williams. We had, you know, Sue followed her big sister, Joni. They couldn't wait to have the job. And other attendants with the Lang girls were, as I mentioned, all the Shute girls, Gail, Lynn, and Janie, the Whitney girls, Lee and Sue, the Tui girls, Mary, Maggie, and Nora, the Trower girls, Jen and Marty. And, you know, they had a tough job, but they also had a lot of fun. And by the way, a lot of the guys went up to hang out with the girls too. So yours truly, here's Brian teeing off, Sue. But here are some of the clubhouse attendants, and here are some of the hangers-on. Does anybody recognize who this individual is?
Oh, please.
This is David Burgess. And this is our one and only David Hill. Here he is again.
I thought those pictures had been burned years ago.
And for the SWAT Fest, my mother used to dress us all the same. And it was a required event. One year we had these 3/4 sleeve boat collars, you know, with the and we wore clam diggers. It was embarrassing. My dad ran a bunch of clinics, and there was something called Lang's Ladies. This isn't that, but this is another clinic. But look how, you know, dried and burnt out the course was in those days, and how few trees we had, as Linda pointed out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here's Joni putting by the field where the shed is. And here's a shot of the fifth green overlooking the stone pier when, you know, Riddle's Market, and I think Seventh Heaven was there. Here's one of the clinics that Bob Buxbaum is running, and I counted roughly about 30 people taking this clinic.
It was Dave Buxbaum, right?
Or not Dave Bob. Dave Buxbaum, sure, yep. So, you know, I've got a lot more stories to relate. I have one, you know, one of my, you know, regrets is that I didn't play as much as I should have when I was a younger man. I have to admit, my father has won the men's championship. My brother has won the men's championship. My son has won the men's championship. All of my sisters have won the women's championship, as did my mother, and I've never won it. So that's one regret that I didn't try early enough. I got into the finals last year, but Quinn Faderly beat me like a drum. So anyway, and the other story I wanted to relate was, this is a fellow named Dave Weld, and Brian relates to me a story. He was there watching this men's championship match, and it's a 36-hole final. The final match is a 36-hole round. So Dave and my dad were all even on the 35th tee. And my father got up there and put it gully. And Dave got up and hit his tee ball right down the center in the fairway. Well, my dad kind of thought he was toast, but he was going to, you know, give it one last try. And he went down in the gully and pulled out a 3-wood and hit it up over the mound. It bounced off the mound on the ninth hole and onto the green. And sure enough, he sunk the putt for a birdie and won the match on that hole. Dave just, he was dumbfounded, but he was able to gain his composure and walk up to my father and shake his hand and say how happy he was to have been in such a great match. So that's the story. This is kind of a people getting ready for a SWAT fest. Notice all the SWAT fest is a social event. It's not really a golf event. So we want, you know, anyone who wants to play, come on out and have a ball. So with that, I'll stop sharing my screen.
Thank you, John. Should I go back to this? Oh, I just wanted to say, we're going to have a question and answer. I mean, maybe no answers, but questions or other people who want to mention something about the golf club now. And I wanted to say one thing, that I am the archivist and I followed Will Sharp, who did that before. And we are extremely lucky to have had all these members before us save all the memorabilia, the minutes of from the beginning. We have only a few years when we don't have minutes of the meetings. Sometimes those minutes were written on the back of letters in pencil, but we still have them. And it's amazing to me. And I would love to share them with everybody, but some of them are so fragile, we can't do that. But I've enjoyed having this job, and I've enjoyed learning every day more about the golf club. And we do want everybody to come up and enjoy it as much as we do. We are very open about that. And should we open it now, David, and questions or statements?
And David, if you could just have people raise their hand. Do we have that feature on this Zoom?
Do they raise their hand or just unmute?
I think they can just unmute themselves.
I think it would be better if we you know, either they raise their hand or try, even just a regular hand.
Just a regular
Mary?
The raise hand feature is found all the way to the left under reactions. If you
right
reactions, it's just above that.
Yeah, they moved it for those people who may have thought it was someplace else. And so David has a list and he can see and he'll call on you if you put your hand up.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, I'll be happy to do that. Or as I say, just go ahead and unmute yourself and you will pop to the top of the list and I can recognize you that way.
Does anyone have a question of Linda or any of the other speakers tonight?
Questions, comments, stories?
Paul El-Hodge.
I'm not seeing anybody.
He put his hand up. He's raised his hand. Just unmute.
Okay. Okay. You can speak. Go ahead and speak.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Unmute. I finally got it on the screen. Okay.
Good. Thank you, Paul.
All right, Jim, you go ahead.
Just a couple minor notes. One plane across the road, we haven't talked about it, but in researching, doing some of the research on the history, there are many clubs, historic clubs that played across roads, including one of the earliest and the Philadelphia Cricket Club, which still plays across the road. Most of the other clubs have changed their courses so they don't. The other point I was going to mention was that I talked to the librarian at the United States Golf Association several years ago about the history of the oldest golf clubhouses in America. And I said that ours was built in 1807. And that I said I didn't know whether it was, there were some clubhouses that are housed in historic buildings built and moved or incorporated into a golf course, such as the Northern Virginia Regional Park Authority's Pohick Golf Course in Virginia, which I think was 1790 something. So I asked how did the 1807 fit in there? And she said, what you can say is that the Chabia Golf Clubhouse is certainly one of the oldest in the nation.
Oh, thank you.
I think Judy Horkey was next.
Yeah.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi, Judy.
Victor Bowen was my dad. He was born in 1904 on the island, and he was the manager of the golf course for many years during the summer. He was a school teacher, and when school got out, we hit Chabig. And those were the happiest years of my life, because I got to go on the beach with my mom and play in the water and swim and do all that stuff. Dad did everything up at the golf course, mowed the greens, managed, he just did it all. Now and then I would get to go and be with him. And I would, if I wasn't in the way, I'd go out and pick those blueberries that were mentioned. And, just have a wonderful day up there. I've played golf there myself quite a while ago now. And I know my family all has and does. We still get up there when we can to visit. I live in California now. My brother has taken a great interest in this whole genealogy thing, which has been fascinating. And I think that's great. I have one of these.
Oh, she has a basket.
I have a basket. My mother.
Great, thank you. Oh, wow.
I love it. I cherish it. Not quite sure where to put it in my will, but.
That's great. Thank you for showing that, because I know there's one up in my sister-in-law's cottage, and I was going up there and I couldn't find the key to their cottage. So show it. Yeah, that's great. Well,
I've got a lot of things that my grandfather, my father's father, Henry, he had the first mail post office. He was the postmaster. And he had a little church there by the view. It's just a lot of history that I absolutely love. I've written a lot about it, and I'm going to get my brother to finish it because I don't think I'm going to live long enough to go through it all. I've got relatives up there now that I adore.
Yeah, like me and Allison. So,
and yeah, Allison and Lindy Smith live there. Mm-hmm. Victoria. Mm-hmm. Smith was my cousin, and she died a few years ago. But anyway, I think this is great fun. And since I now know how to play golf, and now I can't because my back gave out, but I have played there. I've stayed up on the Loki House. Mm-hmm. And hope to stay at the one homestead, maybe.
Oh, that's great, Judy. I hope you, I know when Jeffrey was here, he said you all hope to come back next summer. So we hope to see you here. Thanks for your comment.
Thank you.
Anyone else have something that they would like to add?
Well, one other bit of trivia, and that is the fact that the clubhouse was actually built in Massachusetts, because we all know that Maine became a part of
Massachusetts.
Was a part of Massachusetts at that time. And the building didn't get moved. Andy Grinnell, I see a hand up. Can you can you unmute yourself? There you go.
All right, good. I just want to say this was great. Thank you very much. Huge. Part of the island, and the way in which I imagine it is about the golf course. I mean, it's the introduction to the whole island, and it's such a grand setting. And so suddenly this evening, for the first time after 45 or 50 years, I'm hearing that wonderful history behind it all. And so thank you. This was just great.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Andy. Linda, I was just remembering when Joan and I were doing a lot of interviews back in the 1980s and 90s, we did an interview with Sandy McLean.
Oh, yes.
And do you have a copy of that? There's a video of it, and we may have a copy here, or it's in Joan's house. But he and I think it was Dave Buxbaum, but it could have been God Lang. But I think it was Dave Buxbaum. They wanted to see how many holes they could do in a day. And they started early in the morning. And he tells that story, and that we should, that would be a good one for our next Growing Up on Chabig. If we can find that video, we could transcribe it, because it was a great story. You can just see a couple of boys out there seeing, and they went until the sun, they started at sunrise and went until sunset.
It was my dad and Sandy.
Your father. Okay,
I think they played, Sally may remember, but I think it was something like 106 holes.
It was unbelievable, whatever it was. Day. And to hear Sandy tell it.
And I believe Sally's son, Bryce, tried to go out and break that record just a few years ago, but not sure that happened.
Hello, John.
Yes,
John. It's Sally talking here.
Yeah.
He did. He actually broke Dad's record, and he played. I think he played. What is it? 90. He played 10 rounds, 11 rounds. So he went to what is that? 109 holes, 108 holes. He played, he was determined to play more holes than Dad did. And he actually did it. I think he was 17. And I caddied for him for for not too many, but you know, some of those balls. But Bryce did break the record.
99. Oh, see, that's a great story. Thank you.
A great story. And we love all those stories, and you can send them to Donna or myself or leave them at the golf club, because we always like to add them to our history. Although our shelves are bulging. We have to get some new boxes. We have so much archival material. Anyway.
We need an addition here.
We need an addition for that. And we are having a lot of fun this summer, because last summer it was COVID and we had to not go in the clubhouse and we couldn't have our regular events. So far this summer, it's more normal. It isn't quite normal, as we know. And it's been a lot of fun this summer, I think. And the best part about playing golf on our golf course is stopping and talking to everybody. Oh, you're not supposed to do that on a golf course. Well, we do.
All right. If no one else has anything to add or questions to ask, we'll turn it back to Mary to wrap it up.
Thank you all.
Yes, thank you all for tuning in. We appreciate it. We hope we see you again in September for Dr. Ravi's, Chuck Ravi's lecture.
Not Ravi's, yeah. Radis.
Radis.
Ravi's is, that would be if it was a vet.
Radis. But Linda, thank you for all your work. And we appreciate all that you collaborated on with Donna and the Historical Society. We appreciate it when people use the information we have and share the information that they have. So thank you all. And once again, this lecture doesn't have a glass jar on the table. So please feel free, if you wish, to go on our website and, as you would at the hall, make a little donation to say thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night, all.
Good night.
Good night.